That's Freddie Hubbard with Crisis. That was recorded on August 21st, 1961, in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey. Freddie Hubbard, of course, on trumpet. Wayne Shorter on tenor sax. Bernard McKinney on euphonium. McCoy Tyner on piano. Art Davis on bass. And the great Elvin Jones on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And today we're talking about what seems to be a national urban removal plan. It used to be a joke. It was said in jest back in the 60s when malicious and pernicious urban policies were being formulated and enacted to systematically empty major urban centers across America. But it appears that this is no exaggeration. First, you kill the schools. Last week's teacher sick out in Detroit shut down its public school system for about 3 days and put the national spotlight once again on the beleaguered city's budget woes. The teachers' action came, as you know, after they were told that their salaries would not be guaranteed beyond June the 30th, when emergency funds allocated by the state to run the city's public school system would run out. Detroit's schools long have been the poster child for the many ills that plague the nation's public schools, especially in high-density, predominantly people of color, urban areas across America. Now, the city and just about everything associated with it are widely viewed as being beyond fixing. Detroit's school system didn't just develop problems. It was actually targeted for oblivion long before the rest of the city, says our guest, Dr. Thomas Pedroni. He is an associate professor of curriculum studies and policy sociology at Wayne State University. He also is director of the Detroit Data and Democracy Project. He says race-based policies engineered the demise of the city to make way for a reimagined Detroit. And key to hastening that transition was a wholesale attack on its public schools. And in this regard, he says, Detroit has to be seen as something of a template for what will happen and what has begun to happen across the United States. And Tom, it's a great, great joy and pleasure to have you with us. You always educate us about the seamy underside of education.
I have to say you have the best intro music in radio as well, in addition to being the best talk show on the air. So I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. This is, of course, we can't hope to cover everything today. So I start off by asking for a rain check at some other point close to now where we will continue this discussion. But what is important here is to guide people through the thinking that informs what looks like a fight over education, but really is undergirding a systematic attack against people of color, predominantly so, but poor people across the board. And these policies find a common cause among a curious group of people in different spheres of influence, but they all agree that they should move as one with regard to particular cities. You've been studying this. You and other educators have been studying this, and this is the interesting approach that you take, which is you understand education from an entirely different point of view, and you give us a very keen insight into the structure of racist policies that appear to have nothing to do at all with the current condition, and yet it's at the very center of the the whole removal, the whole systematic emptying of a city, and based on particular criteria. Could you get us close to understanding the basics here?
Sure. Well, a lot of times we look at urban education policy as being sort of its own context, and we talk about things that are important, like neoliberal educational reform, how it works through race and its impact on children and their families. But we have to realize that urban education policy is not isolated and actually partakes in the larger reconstruction of the urban landscape. It's one sector among other sectors: housing, access to water, access to utilities and other forms of urban infrastructure, transportation, even state subsidies. All of those things conspire, or take part in, larger planning over the future direction of the city. And many, including me, have argued, and most importantly, Pauline Lipman in Chicago, have argued that the role of urban education policy is pivotal. It's not just one of many sectors, but in many ways paves the way and really sets the tone. And the reason why, one of the most important reasons why, is the way that schools and school communities are important identity markers for both the people who currently inhabit the city or particular neighborhoods and those who might in the future as well. So the struggle over who the city is for is waged block by block, but also classroom by classroom, school building by school building. So I am, of course, keenly interested in the struggle over education because I care deeply about education as both a potentially liberating form and as a reproductive form, but I also care about it deeply as one very significant element in a larger contest over who the city is for and really who our society is for. And unfortunately, we seem to be moving in a direction increasingly, especially since, I guess you could say, the late 70s or early 80s, where the pathway to future movement of our country has decided that there's a very large segment of its population that is that needs to be accessed. And I think that we see that playing out in Detroit. We see that playing out in a number of other cities. Of course, the key way that it plays out is in the closing of cities. But closing of cities is only one part of a larger project of sort of multi-pronged. It's to break up predominantly black schools and Latino schools and close them. But it's also to make sure that those remnants or vestiges of public schools that remain are as lucrative as possible for those who used to criticize public schooling and demand cost-cutting, taxpayer cost-cutting in relation to public school, now realize that there's great money to be had and that you can mine the bodies of black and Latino children for the per-pupil dollars that cling to them. And I think that's part of the larger project that we see. So that's kind of an overview to get into the specifics of the moment in Detroit right now. You alluded to this conflict where the teachers, in the press, it's been referred to as a sick out or even a strike, but the teachers have regarded it a lot as a lockout. And the reason why they call it a lockout is because, well, work implies an exchange of a service for payment. And based on the very late comments of our fifth emergency manager, Judge Rhodes, when he declared a couple of weeks ago that he had figured out that the monies would run out June 30th, and teachers, especially those teachers who had their salaries allocated over the course of a year, because that's how teachers get by, that they would not receive the last very significant portion of their checks over the rest of the summer, and also summer school and the work inherent in it and the learning inherent in it for children, would also be closed off. And so teachers had calculated that, according to the judge's announcement, that their pay had already ended a day before they decided, before they realized this and decided that they had been locked out, that there was no longer pay being offered in exchange for their services. It's amazing to think about this because at the same time we have very significant legislation that is going through both the House and the Senate, different versions of it in the State House here in Michigan. And those two sets of bills in the House and the Senate compete with each other for the radicalness of their assault on urban populations of color and their educational interests, with the House perhaps being even more draconian and more vitriolic in its assault than the Senate bill. But we view that mainly as a bad cop, good cop strategy, where the end point is that you're still being framed, whether you're a teacher or a student or a family in the city. So basically what the teachers, many teachers are saying is that, in effect, they're being blackmailed to try to support the good cop legislation and its passage, and they're actively being encouraged in this by their union leadership. Currently, our Detroit Federation of Teachers is under receivership from the AFT, and the teachers refer to that as their own emergency management. They say, many of the teachers say that their union is itself being emergency managed, just like the schools are. Many of them find even the Senate bill, the good cop bill, reprehensible for its democracy-destroying qualities, its black voting rights-destroying qualities, and refuse to be blackmailed. And so we have a very interesting situation where you have legislation in process, you have a struggle internal to the union as well. And I guess I'm happy to say there's a core of very energized and very radical and very committed to the community and to the teaching profession teachers who are saying, you know what, this is a struggle over our union, and it's one that we don't intend to lose. And so you're seeing, this is the very hopeful message that I want to share, is that you're seeing new coalitions strengthening in a way that is at least as strong as those coalitions solidified in Chicago behind the core faction, which eventually rose to power in the Chicago Teachers Union, headed by Karen Lewis. So the key players here is what we found in the last 2 or 3 months. So we have the elected school board, which has been almost completely disempowered and is blamed even for the state's destruction, because people don't seem to understand that the board isn't in power, even as it's savaged, and the school district is savaged. The elected board, community, real grassroots community organizations, as opposed to the rent-a-parent AstroTurf organizations that we have here that folks are familiar with in other cities as well, and the most progressive and energized sections of the DFT, the rank and file, those groups are all now on the same page. We've been unified both through their actions and through our own actions in response, in conjunction with friends in the state board, in the legislature, and in universities. And so I need to say we really do have a full-blown movement here now that I think is realizing that while it can't romanticize the amount of power it has, that it does have some real power and some ability to speak back. So especially the leadership of the union has tried to break, to position union members in ways that they will advocate for interests that are directly contradictory to the interests of the Detroit community. The union has both locally and nationally, and that second component is very important to your listenership, I think, have said that the union supports the passage of the Senate package and have urged teachers, you know, if you want to save the schools, they say, you need to go to Lansing and you need to advocate for these bills. And the AFT has sent out a message nationally that people need to call in and support Detroit teachers by supporting the Senate package. While you have so many teachers who are saying, no, no, please, not in our name, don't do that.
I can't help but ask you this question about your coming to terms with these kinds of issues as an educator yourself. I mean, I imagine that you had seen your world as largely dealing with test scores and teacher performance and all the other cliche things that people are said to concern themselves with in the world of education, you know, education theory and teaching methods and all these other kinds of things. When did it dawn on you, or when did it begin to become clear to you that this is not so much about the educational process, but the intent of the policy here to actually achieve the exact opposite, the stultification of targeted groups, the denial of education to targeted groups. And this is a shared interest, a conspiracy of different groups coming together. And it couldn't possibly have been accidental that the struggle remains almost exactly the same in the various locations that they're in, but the bedrock of it seems almost exactly the same, and based on what seems to be the intent to wipe out the educational futures of specific groups. When did that begin to emerge for you as a pernicious pattern that has to be fought against?
Right. Well, I, in terms of personal biography, I want to share just very briefly. I actually was an activist well before I was ever an academic or a scholar. I became active in anti-war movements, in anti-nuclear campaigns, and campaigns against American, you know, colonial and imperialist interventions in Central America and so on, when I was, you know, a teenager in high school. And I only found my deep, keen interest in the world of academia and research and, you know, I guess you could say the intellectuality that's associated with that particular milieu because of social justice investments. So I've always been keenly aware and interested in inequities of race, class, gender, sexuality, language, ability, and so on and so forth. And education, it hasn't been a very artificial process to think about that in relation to education. I was attracted to the field of education because it wasn't just a playful decoding of, you know, Hollywood movies to see what sort of narratives were built into them, but it was actually interacting with institutions on the ground, like schooling and real children. And so that was the great attractor for me. In terms of the intersection of that with what you referred to as, you know, sort of the more seemingly mundane, preparing teachers for the classroom and, you know, for performance on tests and things like that, I've always had a vision of classroom life and practiced it as a teacher. I was a teacher in New Orleans before Katrina and then in the Twin Cities as well. A vision of teaching that was very liberating, and maybe that sounds exotic to say liberating, but what it really meant was, I think, what should be absolutely core and absolutely mainstream to the educational process, which is the idea that the purpose of schooling is for people to be able to understand the world around them, particularly as it presses against them and also enables them, and not only to understand the world in that way, but to be able to act on it as well. And so, you know, I found a lot of affinity with the ideas of Brazilian educator Paulo Freire and many who have followed him in terms of thinking about the strength of education and pedagogy, its core purpose being to both read the world, to read the word, to read the world, and to also be able to impact the world, to write the world. He uses those kind of reading-writing metaphors because he was a literacy teacher. And so to bring it around fully for you and your audience, it's very difficult to make real that sort of high-quality, deeply meaningful educational experience, particularly for urban kids, urban low-income children of color in our schools, because those are the ones that are most put upon by the testing regimes. Those are the ones where the requirements of testing and the way that the schools are framed as being failing schools put those schools and those administrators and those teachers, by calling them failing, under tremendous pressure to do anything possible to pass those tests. And so that means that the schools will push out every part of the curriculum that was humanizing. And that's everything from art to gym to music to extracurricular programs. Even social studies has been marginalized extensively, even science. And the core focus has really been on a very reductionist version of math and English language arts, where even in those areas, creativity, critical thinking, all of those things go out the door. So the policies directly make teaching in its most visionary and practical utopian way almost beyond reach. And so in order to make education, make schooling, if you want to call it that, live up to the tremendous potential that it does actually have, we have to push against all these things. And that's when one realizes that, you know what, there's something about the ways in which the curriculum is, as it is imposed from above, is about demeaning and lessening and cheapening Black minds and their Latino minds and really the minds of all of us in imagining and visioning a different creative potential future, to also directly moving those bodies out as well. So it's bodies and minds that together are being shut down in this process. So you begin to see how it's about who gets to own and control the city and our society, and who gets shut out as well.
And this, by the way, this becomes all the more ironic when you consider the intensity has picked up quite a bit under an African-American president.
Yes.
And you have a national teachers union essentially not screaming to the hilt about its expected role in maintaining a silence about what education policy is causing to happen. And that is the creation of an extremely unequal America and the forfeiting of the educational futures of a whole millions and millions of children. I was imagining that this would have been something of such a crisis and such a gaping wound, such an open contradiction here, that the United States government for the last two administrations at least would have been consumed with this. It's not because there aren't people like you and others with vision who can see that there's something dramatically wrong. The obvious racial imbalance here and the use and the targeting of these communities. And now you have a swarming, a perfect storm of co-conspirators. You have the real estate industry. Yeah. That is now looking to these cities that have become suddenly desirable, and mm-hmm. all kinds of plans are being manufactured to reimagine them, to bring in the right people. You have overt expressions by people like Governor Snyder of Michigan saying, you know, we want to bring in the right people. We also yeah. want to get rid of the wrong people who are here. You have educational institutions and nonprofit groups seeing huge amounts of money to be made by literally destroying a system that supposedly is at the bedrock of a democratic society and that would perform the essential function of socializing. One of the first and most important socializing agents in the formation of a nation. So what happened here that all of a sudden we're seeing in Baltimore, in Washington, D.C., in New York City, and in Detroit, we're seeing it in all over the United States, especially in these communities of color. And yet we don't see from the point of view of those historically, those institutions historically concerned about equality and so forth, screaming about the fact that there is a conspiracy afoot and people are agreeing to do this in deliberate fashion. And they're utilizing the power of the and authority of the state, and they're using official policy to get these things done.
That's right. And they're also using foundations, which, as you pointed out, which people are used to thinking of as benevolent organizations that are there to provide some sort of social structural support when the state hasn't already provided it. You see those organizations and even traditional civil rights organizations that have in many localities, although it's a little bit differentiated depending on what city you're talking about, become part of the press for this type of educational change and larger social change in the urban landscape. You also have the appropriation of all kinds of formerly liberatory discourses, including civil rights discourse. So if you look at any of the literature promoting vouchers or promoting what are largely in Michigan for-profit charters, educational choice, so-called, has a black face, you know, on every cover. If you have, have the displeasure of regularly receiving the Friedman Foundation's mailings on education, and it's an African American child on the cover almost every single time that I receive that. So, in a city like Detroit, for example, where there is so little infrastructure left in terms of everything from private sector job opportunities for young people to public sector job opportunities, all there really is foundation life. And you see many otherwise what would be outspoken leaders of local community organizations who feel in a double bind because on the one hand, they want to speak out and call what is happening what it is. On the other hand, they're able to hang on to the small program that allows them to do some of the work in their life that they've wanted to do because of some of those very foundations, the foundations that might fund community activists or organizations like that at the rate of $20,000 or $30,000 a year, but are funding the EAA or Teach for America at the rate of several million dollars a year. That puts a lot of the traditional progressive organizations in a double bind. And my good friend Elena Harada has referred to it as sort of like invasion of the body snatchers, that your friend who was your comrade and your ally suddenly is zombified or something, because now they're on the payroll of the foundations as well.
What do you see as the game plan here? If you were to say, if you were to issue a dire warning today, what would you say to people that they should be on the lookout for the way things are going?
Always look behind the cover of who is funding, who it is that you're speaking to. Because one thing that we know is that the process of dispossession is becoming increasingly sophisticated. So, I mean, I think that examples of that abound, but a key example in Detroit is our Detroit Future City Plan, which I think I've mentioned once before on your program. But what the Detroit Future City Plan does, and it's now been endorsed by the governor and by Mayor Duggan in Detroit, by all the foundations, what it does is it sketches out a map for the city and says that some areas of the city are only to receive patchwork public investment, and that the scarce public dollars in a time of austerity should go to the market performers, to the neighborhoods and the interests that have produced value. So in other words, what we used to call well-to-do or wealthy neighborhoods that don't normally need much, and the poor performing, those neighborhoods that are performing poorly in the housing markets, in other words, poor neighborhoods, you don't throw good money after bad. So if their water infrastructure is leaky, you might patch it up to preserve its life a little bit longer, but you don't do a wholesale infrastructural upgrade, but you do those in the neighborhoods that you want to reward for performing so well. So I may have gotten away a little bit from your initial question, but I think that you were asking about what should people watch out for. And so I was describing the Detroit Future City Plan. As terrible as what I just described sounds, on the other hand, there are many environmental groups in the city, and those groups that want, you know, architectural preservation, and those who want to advocate for livable downtowns and walkable spaces, their footprint is also all over the Detroit Future City map, so that what they don't call it bulldozing your neighborhood to build a highway now, which might be more the plan of the 50s or 60s to build the interstate so that mostly white folks could zip in and out and still have those jobs without having to live by you anymore. Now it's you will be liberated in your isolation if you choose to stay there, because what we're going to do is, as your area is experiences increasing disinvestment and as more and more people move out of your neighborhood, we are going to mothball it. And that's for future real estate development, because you can't have all this open real estate hit the market at the same time. That doesn't work for the urban growth machine, the real estate and financial interests. So we'll mothball all of this by turning it into green spaces and blue spaces. And blue spaces, of course, means water features, they refer to it. We had one of the, and this is, I think you just find this interesting, the executive director of Detroit Future City was the daughter of the immediate past president of the Skillman Foundation, which is our local partner in the educational realm to Broad and Gates and Walton, that helped to incubate the EAA and this sort of market competition among schools that called for the abolition of the elected school board. So her daughter is the one who runs this Detroit Future City Plan, and she's a very likable woman. I saw her speaking on television about the giving the public an update about the Detroit Future City Plan. And so, you know, she was asked about people who are left behind in these neighborhoods, and she said, oh, no, we're no longer talking about forced relocation here. People can stay if they want to, and what they will have will be in their neighborhood will be, can you imagine, water swells. I don't even know what a water swell is, but I imagine it must be pretty nice. And that if you live home on the range, poor, without any more infrastructure support, it must make your life very desirable. But so my point is that power is so sophisticated now, and dispossession is so sophisticated, that incredible violence is being wrought on a people using a language that is often quite progressive and liberatory. So in the educational realm, all of this privatization stuff, you know, no child left behind, all of it speaks in the language of civil rights and equity and delivers, as we've seen, what is quite the opposite, the complete decimation of public schools in urban neighborhoods. All of this functions, as my colleague at Wayne State, Peter Hammer, talks about it in terms of, he put up a map of Detroit and he said, look, hydrogeologists know how to move around water in a given area like a city. And they think about where you're going to be, how do you get the water where you want it and where you don't want it. And Peter Hammer refers to that same process in relation to people. So one of the tools that the developers no longer have here is the use of eminent domain for the pursuit of private interests. But as Peter Hammer argues, the social science of dispossession is so sophisticated now that you know how to engage in policy that moves people around on the urban landscape just like as if they were water. So you can confine them where they need to be, move them from one area to another, just as you would with water, and you do that through policy instruments.
And schools are one of the best places to start. You kill them off so yeah. that you can get both the land and the people, and you can manipulate both at the same time. And this is why yeah. it's so important to pay attention to the fact that this program of targeting schools is not just accidental at all.
No.
I want to ask you to go back to the Katrina moment, and the Katrina moment being that point at which tragic circumstances, I mean, the scales are so tilted against the local people, and you would think that every effort would be made to revitalize them and to resuscitate them and the communities in which they live, and yet it's exactly the opposite. In terms of education, what is the model that was followed in New Orleans after Katrina hit, and what we are now seeing unfold in places like Detroit and Chicago?
Well, I mean, the first thing to note is that it's how explicitly New Orleans has been the roadmap in places like Detroit. So in the years before the assault really started, those of us who knew what to look for were already seeing it, as there were as folks from our local foundations who brought this out were engaged in cultural exchanges with their counterparts in New Orleans to see what was being done there. We had lots of programs on Michigan Public Radio, radio programs that were funded by the foundation that were touting what a wonderful success they were experiencing in New Orleans public schools and how this represented a roadmap for Detroit as well. And the basic enemy, if you are a corporate reformer, are things like, I mean, in general, you don't like anything about the public and the public sector. You don't like the idea of citizen control. You want to instead move to something that is more along a corporate model, which they term as being more efficient, less subject to political pressures. And you want to also, beyond that, You also despise teacher unions because you see them as being monopolistic. You don't like the idea of public schools in general because you say, while there may be some, we're willing to kind of throw you a bone and say there's a public good in education, nevertheless, it doesn't need to be delivered by public providers. Anyone can deliver it. So it's a multi-pronged assault on every notion of the public. And you saw that in New Orleans. New Orleans is now almost completely charterized. And I think something that's important to note as an aside is, on the surface, we seem to be getting some good news a few days ago. I don't know if you are aware of this, Utris, but there is legislation moving through the Louisiana legislature right now that, at least in terms of the headlines, would return charter schools, take them from the recovery school district, their version of the Education Achievement Authority, although theirs is not just in New Orleans, and return them, the ones in New Orleans, for example, to the New Orleans public, the Orleans Parish Public School Board. And at first I thought, wow, you know, that sounds like it's a democratizing movement. But then the activists in New Orleans, like Karen Harper Royal and Ray Sanders and many others, if you haven't had them on your show, you really need to. They said, no. You know, pay attention to what's actually going on here. Because the schools are being returned to a public school board, at which, by the way, you know, now there's tons of money flowing into public school board races like you see in Los Angeles. But the charters are immune from any sort of change or improvement from the public school board. So the actual ability to do anything with those charters is completely taken away, and the district only plays a very removed managerial role. So it looks like democratization, and that's been a theme actually in the foundation, in the vulture philanthropic world or the venture philanthropic world recently, is this notion of, you know what, we were doing the right thing, but we were doing it the wrong way because we alienated local populations who saw what we were doing as undemocratic. So now their real commitment is to make their movement seem as democratic as possible. And so the restoration of, supposedly, of the Orleans Parish Public School Board over charters in the city seems to be a gesture to that, where it really doesn't amount to very much. And I encourage you to have, for example, Karen Harper Royal on your program because she can speak to that quite well since she's seeing it up close and personal right now. But yeah, that is the roadmap in Detroit too, is to charterize the population. And here it's been less, it was less initially take over the district and charterize all the schools. So that has been an element, and that's how it worked in New Orleans. It's been more take over the school district and make conditions in the school so miserable through, blatant mismanagement and even corruption and moving funds out of the classroom and into central administration and into consulting contracts, that you further encourage the flight to charter schools that are outside the purview of the public schools. So the Detroit public schools do authorize some charters, but not most of them, only a very small number. Most of the charter sector is outside of the Detroit public schools state management.
I have to ask about this, the issue of race here.
Yeah.
These horrible, horrible things are happening almost exclusively, it seems, in communities of color. I don't recall well-to-do, middle-income white communities having to grapple with these issues, and certainly if they do, not on this scale.
Mm-hmm.
What you've been studying the demographics of this. What have you come up with as a picture of the correlation between policy and race?
Well, so first of all, Detroit is, as a city, is 82% African American, and it's imagined in the white imaginary, it's definitely a totally black city, and that's been a huge barrier to the urban growth machine, that sort of hybrid of real estate and financial interests and all the sectors that are connected to that and that benefit from the success of those sectors. Their problem has been that they have, that in previous generations, they so successfully branded Detroit as a black nightmare to whites city, you know, to the extent that when I was a teacher in the northern suburbs before, a university professor, a teacher educator, so many of my budding teachers there really believed the notion that if you stepped foot in Detroit, you would just be killed immediately. And that sounds like I'm exaggerating, but I required students to do neighborhood study in Detroit. And some of them talked about having panic attacks when they stepped out of their cars, because their fathers usually had told them that if you go to Detroit against my wishes, either you'll be killed while you're there, and if you're not, I'll kill you when you come home. And this was a theme among so many white suburbanites. So when you have that white imaginary about the city of Detroit, it's really difficult if you're now part of the real estate and finance sector to be able to brand the city as a place to live, right? So it's been a lot of work, a lot of very difficult work of rebranding the city, right? And you know, they've worked very creatively, though. You know, they capitalize on the sense of Detroit's grittiness and, you know, and Eminem is from here and hip-hop and stuff like that. There's a history of Motown as a way of branding the city at the same time that they're disconnecting those who created that culture from participation or even really much interacting with the new residents who come here. And in that sense, it's a lot of similarity with New Orleans too, right? So the great appeal of New Orleans is, you know, jazz and Creole cooking and all this kind of stuff. And the very culture that produced that is what needs to be cordoned off, if not expelled from the city, it's certainly cordoned off from the tourist sector, so as not to interfere with the profit-making that takes place out of the colorfulness that those people and their predecessors, cultural predecessors themselves produce. So you have that in Detroit as well. You've got a lot of work to do to make people want to be in Detroit. So one of the things, what that looks like on the ground right now is you see a lot of young white professionals put bumper stickers on their Apple laptops that say, Detroit hustles harder. You know, they've appropriated that sense of, you know, almost like drug dealing metaphors or something to be able to vest themselves into that grittiness and that sense of being, you know, living in a Wild West environment. And I guess it's very, exciting for young people, and they say Detroit is the new Brooklyn now. So it's horrifying, but also very interesting to watch that process take place really up close of how do you do that? I mean, you think it would be almost impossible. How are you going to get white people to move back into Detroit? And they're doing it. And, you know, as we've talked about before, what happens in the schools is a key component of that. And race is absolutely central. The neoliberalization of the city is not a raceless process. It absolutely is about race, and it uses race as a very significant tool and lever. I think that sort of project of capital, I mean, neoliberalism is maybe a 30-year-old rendition of it, but that sort of project of capital has always been there, the usefulness of race.
Again, I go back to the fact that a lot of this was accelerated under President Obama and his Chicago buddy, Arne Duncan, who he named Secretary of Education. Mm-hmm. Do you think people even begin to understand the enormity of the irony of this, that here we have a president under whose administration we saw incredible numbers of schools being closed? We see a horrible attack, a persistent attack on public schools. We see the targeting of communities in all these different ways in order to empty them, to even force them, as in the case of Detroit, to force these cities into bankruptcy. And therefore, in the case of Michigan as a whole, Elena Herrera had told us about this, that every single black city pretty much is under emergency management. And these blatantly race-based policies are being enacted by a, quote, liberal president and one who is of African-American stock. What does this tell us about politics and the presumption that liberals somehow are better and conservatives or Republicans or whoever.
Right. Well, I mean, I think something that many of us noted back in the mid-90s was the irony that it was a Democratic president who presided over the worst excesses of dismantling what very limited version of the welfare state we ever had in the United States, of a social safety net, and of criminalizing whole portions of the population along racial lines. So, you know, there's been the recent talk about the super predator term. You know, we had the crime bill and welfare reform, so-called, all under the Clintons. And I don't think that's lost on anyone, right? I mean, the Democrats began to pursue a strategy, which is highly ironic, after, what was it, Mondale's loss, where they basically said, you know, they didn't use these words, but we need to become the neoliberal party and sort of take away the core rhetoric of the Republicans. And that's why we speak very clearly that the social policies of Obama are well to the right of Nixon and even to the right of Reagan. Because we're in such a different moment in terms of our common sense understanding of the relationship between the state and the populace. The notion of a social contract has just been utterly decimated, at least for the most vulnerable sectors of our society. So, you know, if as soon as your strategy is to try to grab the core of the other party, what the other party does is it moves farther to the right to distinguish itself from you. And so in many ways, the Democrats have become the standard bearers of some of the worst excesses. And you see that not just on a federal level, but also on a state level, on a municipal level. So on a state level, Jennifer Granholm, who was a Democrat, was the one who actually first put Detroit Public Schools under emergency management, with Robert Bob, who was a Broad Foundation superintendent's fellow, and Broad himself calls himself a lifelong Democrat, Eli Broad. He's from Detroit. And the foundations are mostly populated. Certainly their spokespersons are all people who are Democrats and are well known as Democrats. Mayor Duggan is a Democrat. They're the ones who are forwarding this agenda. Not alone either. I mean, obviously, mostly with the collusion of at least the elements of the Republican Party that are not part of the Tea Party. They're very much in collusion over many of these issues. So, in some ways, you could say maybe this could only happen under someone like Obama, right? I mean, for one thing, think about the ways in which, and I think this is changing now, but certainly for the first several years after Obama came to power, it was incredibly demobilizing in the African-American community in places like Detroit, demobilizing in the sense that there was, you know, thankfully, a sense of great satisfaction, you know, that this represented a victory of some sorts, that Obama had been elected, and a sense of, you know, well, we can take a break. We've been carrying a heavy burden for so long, and look at this great accomplishment. And it was incredibly demobilizing. I mean, that's one of the problems, is that you had this tremendous energy that was built behind Barack Obama, and that mobilization just kind of dissipated once he was actually elected, whereas it could have certainly continued after that. I can't help but note that the Democrats declared their social democratic wing dead more than 20 years ago now, with the birth of the so-called Blue Dog Democrats and the Detroit Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, which the Clintons and both Hillary and Bill were central to. Yet here we are in 2016, and it doesn't look like Bernie will, you know, he may not make it, but that he could be such a popular candidate and clearly be not just of the social democratic wing, but probably even maybe a little bit to the left of the social democratic wing of the Democratic Party, really says something about the political calculus of the Democrats. I mean, maybe it never really was about, maybe the social democratic agenda of the old Democrats was always sort of a rhetorical way of gaining power, but at least as a viable election strategy, Bernie's not missing by too much.
I tell you, we talk about that on this program quite a bit.
Yeah.
Well, we've come to the end of the program today, Tom, but I really, really would love for you to clear some portion of your schedule soon where we can continue this, because this is really deep instruction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it helps people to put a bunch of things together, and you see the big picture, which is why you can't get sidetracked by this event happening here and something else happening there and a news headline over there. You see that there are people who have taken the time to give us the big picture, based not just on a gut feeling, but careful study. They know what is happening. Mm-hmm. And we are in a moment, this is my own little theory, we are in a moment where, despite the awesome challenges that we have, we also have a kind of fertile moment here to gather our senses and do something effective for the future. And but it requires us to approach this process very differently from the knee-jerk way that we've been reacting. We have to be quite strategic and scientific in the way we take on that struggle.
Absolutely.
So I want to thank you so much for being with us today, and hopefully when you have a chance, you can give me a yell and tell me when next you might be available to do part two.
I would love that. I would love that. And thanks again. You just always love being on your show so much.
Thank you so much. That brings us to the end of our program. Our guest, Dr. Thomas Pedroni, Associate Professor of Curriculum Studies and Policy Sociology at Wayne State University and Director of the Detroit Data and Democracy Project, an extraordinary human being who has devoted his entire professional life to trying to improve things in education for all people. Great, great person, and I I value his participation today, and I hope you got a lot out of it, as did I. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. And tomorrow, of course, is Free Your Mind Friday, so you want to get your brains in gear for that. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company, and of course today in the company of Dr. Pedroni. Bye-bye.